Товарищи, период, отделяющий нас от 19...
Долой его! И похоронить его чем глубже, тем...
Мы говорили, что мы имеем бомбу в 100 миллионов. Это верно, но...
Не летайте вы в социалистические страны.
Коммунистическая партия Советского Союза приведет советский народ к полному торжеству коммунизма.
It began with an offhanded and insensitive comment an old man made to a teenage girl at an elite Soviet retirement complex on a warm spring day back in 1981. And it ended more than three decades later with an exploration into a famous family's hidden history and an examination of a nation's tortured soul. That old man was Vyacheslav Molotov, Joseph Stalin's ruthless and powerful foreign minister. And the teenage girl was Nina Khrushcheva, great-granddaughter of the former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, Stalin's successor and Molotov's bitter rival. The book that conversation ultimately inspired, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, was recently published in the United States. And we're going to discuss it, and the Khrushchev legacy and its relevance to Russia's today, with the author. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School and, as I've noted, author of the recently published book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome back, Nina. Congratulations on finishing this project, and you've certainly given us a lot to chew on in the next hour or so.
Thank you.
And also joining me from our studio in Prague is Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Welcome back, Mirhat. You're becoming a regular on the podcast, and that's fine with me.
No, thank you for having me here.
I'm always glad to have you. Nina, of course, we're going to get the ball rolling with you. Walk us back through that conversation you had back in 81 with Molotov at the Zhukovka retirement complex outside of Moscow. The event that seems to have inspired this book, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it became the source of this book. I don't know. I mean, I think Vladimir Putin inspired this book more than anything. But it was the beginning of that thought that I had what was Khrushchev's legacy, Nikita Khrushchev's legacy, but also what was his son's legacy. It's called The Lost Khrushchev, and the book essentially is about Khrushchev's oldest son, Leonid Khrushchev, who died in 1943 in an air battle, and who was by birth, by blood, is my grandfather. So when I talked to Molotov at the time in 81, he was the first one to mention not only Khrushchev's son, because I grew up as Khrushchev's granddaughter. I mean, I did know that he had a son, and that son was my mother's father, but he was really never mentioned at home. My mother had a portrait hanging of him on our living room wall, but that was it. We never discussed it. And so Nikita Khrushchev was my grandfather. Suddenly this old man says, Leonid, there was a new KGB rumor that Leonid was a traitor, and I was 16, and I really was not going to think about Leonid at the age of 16 in any way. Also, I was shocked to meet Molotov himself, because for me, he was a stuff of legends, and also is a very negative stuff of legends, because I always thought that he was great Khrushchev's rival. And finally, he was there in flesh and blood, and in fact, talking to me and saying something that I don't want to know, didn't want to hear. So it was a huge shock, and I then tried to talk to my relatives, to my family, to my mother, and nobody wanted to discuss Molotov with me, nobody wanted to discuss Leonid with me, nobody wanted to I was reprimanded for even talking to him, although as if I had a choice. And so it kind of moved on, and I guess 30 years later I realized that I needed to explore that story in relation to the new story that came out openly in Putin's Russia now, that Leonid, in fact, did not die in World War II, but he was a traitor, and Joseph Stalin, in fact, tried to steal him from the Nazis and killed him, and that's why Khrushchev, in fact, tried de-Stalinization and had his 20th Party Congress.
Yeah, no, the allegations against your grandfather, Leonid, did resurface in the Putin era as well. Well, Dmitry Yazov, the last Soviet defense minister and one of the 1991 coup plotters, wrote in his memoir, Blows of Fate, in 2000, the same rumor. And it surfaced regularly in the media over the past decade or so. Mirka and I were talking off mic a couple of days ago, and he said he just saw a program on Russian TV praising Beria and criticizing Nikita Khrushchev for "quote unquote" repressing him. Mirka, is that not correct?
Yeah, there was not like direct accusations against Khrushchev, but they say Khrushchev sotovarishi, Khrushchev and his company, they did a bad thing. They persecuted Beria, who in fact was protecting Russia's interests or Soviet interests or the country's interests and stuff like that. And I am surprised, even though I am out of the former Soviet Union for many years, it's appalling to see how things are changing. And in the last, I would say, year, it has changed dramatically. And I don't know what's going to happen in the next 1 year if it goes like this. Then there will be open accusations or... You know, we know that Stalin already is pronounced as a most successful manager in the Russian history. So now probably Beria is going to be like the greatest manager.
Human resources chief.
Yeah, and whoever tried to persecute him and to pronounce he's both a criminal. They, you know, we expect that that was a Mr. Khrushchev, of course, and we, I don't know, I'm afraid to say that, but it looks like it's going in that direction.
Nina, you've given us a lot to chew on in this book, but one thing I wanted to kind of, what did you find out about, I mean, we all know it because we've read it, but the listeners haven't, hopefully they soon will. What did you find out about your grandfather in
Well, I really wanted to find out why everybody was so silent. What, in fact, if he was not a traitor, and, you know, I kind of assumed that he wasn't, because he had medals given to him after he died, although he was reported missing in action, and in missing in action in the Soviet Union could mean a lot of things, and most of them actually, once you're missing in action or a prisoner of war, you're actually a traitor to your nation just by definition, because Stalin had very brutal prisoner of war policy. So, but in Leonid's case, missing in action actually was not a crime. Somehow he was posthumously given a medal, and therefore I assumed that he was not a traitor. But I couldn't understand why everybody was so silent about him. What did he do? And what I really discovered is that he was just a human being. He was sort of one of those bread boys. Boys will always be boys. He acted irresponsibly. But also what I found out is that he was the first dissident. I know it sounds grand, and it's not, I mean, when dissidentship was not even an issue, nobody even knew what it was. And my mother said, well, you make him into a hero. And I said, well, he was a hero. He was trying to be human in a system that was not. And one of the, I think what I've discovered is that the greatest reason why his father, Nikita Khrushchev, was so critical of him all his life is because Leonid was a rebel within a communist cause. He was sort of this James Dean of Soviet nomenklatura who refused to play by the rules, who didn't want to study Communist Party history. And Mirkat and I know how difficult it is not to study Communist Party history. I mean, you really have to have an A, otherwise you're out of school and out of Komsomol and whatnot. And Leonid, even in mid-1930s, in 1937, he refused. He didn't want to do it. He had his own uniform. He always invented these very greatest fashions. Yeah. And he was reprimanded for that. In fact, he was imprisoned for that. And I think since my family, my grandmother, my grandfather, I call Nikita Khrushchev my grandfather, so that's who I refer to. They were great communist orthodox. So anything out of the ordinary in human terms was becoming a crime. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting that when I was growing up, they were much more forgiving. And another thing that I found out, they were more forgiving of girls than they are forgiving of boys, which is interesting because it is a patriarchal system and the boys seem to be getting away with more. But at the same time, since women were often invisible to a degree, for example, when Svetlana Stalin, I don't talk about it in the book, but it was interesting when Svetlana Stalin, as Stalin's daughter, immigrated in 1968 so she went to India and then to the United States, and my mother brought those news. Krisha said, well, you just, she couldn't. She was a good Soviet girl. You always bring these horrible rumors from, by the way, Radio for Europe. And they were called, they were all the Vrazhesky Glasa, so the enemy voices. You always bring this kind of information. This is ridiculous. Then he went, he had his own shortwave radio, went to listen to his own Vrazhesky Glasa, to the enemy voices, found out that it is indeed the case, came, apologized to my mother, and immediately blamed KGB for that. She said, no, it's because KGB made her do it. So in some ways, what I discovered, it was harder to be a woman, but it was also easier to be a woman, because there would be less, you would be judged more for some things, but at the same time, you would be judged less because, you know, whatever, what do you take from, I mean, kind of Vladimir Putin's recent comment on Hillary Clinton, you know, she's a weak sex, what do you want from her?
Yeah, which was the latest of a string of sexist comments about women, right, that the Russian president had made. Now, you finally got a final answer from the prosecutor general's office back in 2004, right? That he wasn't a traitor, there were no criminal cases against him or anything of that sort. I read through that.
Well, we just found out. I mean, the reason we wanted, as I said, we knew. I mean, I wanted to find out why everybody was silent. And they were silent because he was human versus communist. But also, and I think my mother was not talking about it because it was easier not to talk about it. In fact, I actually describe it in the book that I had to fish out her archives from under the bed, and because they were hidden so deeply, so she didn't want to have any memories of any of this, any problems. But we wanted to find out kind of legitimately or legally that he was not. So try to stop all this press and books, accusations that you mentioned, Yazov, and in fact took them to court. And it really didn't bring any results because the books continue to be written, the stories still to come out. But it was important. I think still this piece of paper is still very, very important that Leonid was not part of any criminal anything, and he did indeed die March 11th, 1943, so he could not have been captured by the Nazis or defect to the Nazis after that. So he was last seen in a battle, and then he died the day he was seen in a battle.
How much of this, of researching and writing this, was a kind of a catharsis for you? I mean, I kind of sensed that that kind of came through in the book very much. And what most surprised you in going through this, pleasantly or unpleasantly?
That's a great question. I not that it surprised me, but I was shocked by how much everybody lies. I was surprised by the extent everybody lies. How, especially when you come out of family like that, I'm sure your family, older members lie because they want to look good. Everybody wants to look good. But when you're related to the big man, everybody wants him to look good. And especially if this is a man who was ousted in 1964, by those who succeeded him, then, and he was then in retirement, kind of almost in seclusion for almost 10 years, then they want him to look even better because he's, I think, as Mirkat mentioned, his legacy is in trouble. Either was he a great man? Was he a great politician? Was he horrible voluntarist, as he was accused of being? So everybody lies. My mother wanted me. That's why I actually wrote it in English to degrees, just because she, if it were in Russian, she would be free to read pieces and say, well, you can't say that. No, you can't say that. And when I was writing about Leonid, I used his personal file, which was, you know, a scandal, really, because he was a D student, right. most of all, because he was not studying Communist Party. And my grandmother Nina wanted my aunt to burn that file because it was so embarrassing for the Khrushchevs, and they didn't burn it. And so I used it, and my mother kept saying, well, this is betrayal, she said to me. You really cannot use it. I was like, well, what? I'm telling that story. So I learned that. I learned that everybody lies and want to look good. I learned that I actually really like Leonid more than I probably like anybody else in the family, because I don't know how much he was thinking about his rebellious nature, but, you know, it took some guts to say, or apparently, according to that file, you know, he was giving these evaluations, and the evaluations state that he was screaming at party or Komsomol meetings.
In the 30s.
Screaming, you know, just go away. This is all not interesting. I'd rather do something else. He was friends with Trotsky because he never betrayed friends. I mean, one of the things I loved is that he had friends in the city. And therefore, that was a crime because, right. Oh, my God, he was not spending time in the barracks, but he was actually having good time in the city. So I learned all these wonderful things. I mean, the really great personal things about him. I learned, for example, that he and Vasily Stalin, nobody knows that, they dated the same woman, Yekaterina Tymoshenko, Marshal Tymoshenko's daughter.
Oh God.
And there were some fantastic anecdotes about that was told to me by Maria Budionnaya, the wife of, now late wife of, great Soviet Marshal Semyon Budionny, that in fact they dated the same woman, then Leonid. She was, Ekaterina apparently was madly in love with Leonid, but then she married Vasily Stalin when Leonid died in 43. So all these things came to light, and so it was that generation, skipped generation of the Khrushchevs, my mother's father's generation. I mean, and I gave him voice, and I gave voice of all these other women, who my grandmother Nina, who stood next to Khrushchev but was always silent, but then still talked to me. And so I tell a lot of stories, and I checked kind of the legitimacy of the Soviet cause through her, because if Khrushchev was Orthodox, she was beyond Orthodox. Mm-hmm, I think she was on the level of Molotov. Communism does not make mistakes.
Right. Merkat, do you have any? Because do you have any questions that you would want to? You read the book as well, and were as fascinated by it as I was.
Yeah, I was fascinated. The only thing is, I feel that this is a huge work, and I don't have many questions. I just want to express my how impressed I was with that book, because my generation practically has no information about Khrushchev. When we grew up, first time when I was started hearing something about Khrushchev, there were anecdotes when I was 10.
And you were born in 63.
I was born in 63, yeah.
So you were born under Khrushchev.
Yeah, I was born under Khrushchev, and I was born as you were born.
I was born in 63 under Kennedy.
Yeah.
I heard nothing but, I heard quite a bit about Kennedy,
and,
even after he was gone.
That was surprising because, you know, when I started realizing, well, there was a leader of our country, the Soviet Union, and nobody speaks about him, only anecdotes about Quarren, Kukuruza, and stuff, and this is it. Nothing. Some funny songs about Tereshkova and Khrushchev and this, all this stuff. This is it. And then later, when I talked to my father, who was a journalist, very good journalist and satire journalism, he started telling me many things, mainly because my own family had a lot of tragedy during Stalin regime period. And he was telling me how things were different under Khrushchev, and how now it's kind of, again, forgotten. But, you know, tell you frankly, when I was like 15, I didn't pay much attention to all what my dad said. We were listening to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, in all possible languages we could understand. We could understand several languages, Kazakh, Tatar, Azerbaijani, and Russian.
Yeah.
We were listening to this. We were hearing some stuff about Khrushchev and thing. And then I realized that something is wrong. I knew that in this country, but when I was 18 already, if something is hidden, then it is interesting.
Uh-huh.
And we have feeling about it. Well, thanks to my dad, I knew about him. And the only thing I can say that for me, the book was important because I got so many details which I was deprived of when I was a kid.
What I found interesting was the portraits of life inside the Khrushchev household after 64. It's just because that was a period, I mean, we all know the outlines of the history and what happened during the Khrushchev period, that he was deposed in 64. And then he kind of disappears. But he was the first. I actually checked this. I couldn't find a Russian leader before him, any Russian leader, that left
that left office and continued alive. They since then he's kind of started a tradition. We've had since him we've had Gorbachev, we've had Yeltsin. We still don't know if we've had Medvedev technically, and we still don't know if what's going to happen with Putin. But he lived for
lived for 7 years. But it is indeed true. I mean, actually, as I think I wrote in the book that. Is that when he was ousted in 64, and as Mirkat mentioned, because it's indeed true, anything that was done in the Soviet Union then from 53 when Stalin died to 64 when Khrushchev was ousted was done, I'm sure you remember, Mirkat, by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Right. Communist Party of the Soviet Union did not have a leader at the time.
right.
And he, when he was ousted, he said his last day on the job, he said, the best thing I've done today is that I'm ousted by mere voting. Because, of course, years before he would have gone and finished his life in the gulag somewhere.
But I thought the portrait of life in the Khrushchev household after 64, I found that just fascinating, because this had never happened before. You had a Russian ruler who is now in retirement. It's commonplace in Western countries for rulers to leave power and be in retirement, and they live with the. But this was interesting. What it was, you were part of the privileged elite, but yet not in a different sense. So I found that interesting. One other thing I wanted to touch on was the Khrushchev's legacy as a barometer in Russia, because in reform times, like during Perestroika, he's viewed very positively.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed in your book you had a photo of you together with Mikhail Gorbachev, and I thought that was kind of... and he's viewed negatively in times of retrenchment. And as you mentioned, in the Brezhnev period, he seemed to be airbrushed from history. And in the Putin period, he's been besmirched. He's been slandered in the press. Most recently, with the Crimea annexation, for example, you could see in Putin's speech to Parliament when he says, you know, and Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine. Непонятно почему. You know, we don't know why. Nina, can you comment on this as a Khrushchev? I mean, he's kind of a barometer in this sense, and about the most recent, you know, in lieu of the Crimea annexation as well.
And we talked about it on this program,
is
that how he suddenly became the worst guy in Soviet history. I think what you said was interesting about the portrait. I mean, it's really remarkable, because in free country you retire and you could kind of tell stories. Today was George Bush's, the first George Bush.
He jumped out of
birthday.
An airplane the other day.
Right, exactly. So we were talking about this. So this is all common. In the Soviet Union, of course, it was not. And, you know, those stories that I was talking about, you know, how he was grooming those incredible tomatoes that died on the day of the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. I thought it was, you know, kind of this combination of personal and political was really something very interesting and I guess unusual, because once you write stories about former leaders, you, at least in the Soviet Union, you really write about their kind of personal side. But and I think exactly because of that personal side that Khrushchev had and openly had, is that he does become a barometer of how Russian politics works. So when we are in a sort of oppression period, we hate Khrushchev because he squandered away, I mean, Crimea, he squandered away territories. He tried to break the communist monolith. He went to the United States in 59 and brought back the washing machine. So these poor Russian women are not going to wash things on that, you know, ridiculous Soviet, I don't even know, desk or whatever it was, desk, the board, whatnot. So he becomes that barometer. But I think, and in fact, in the book, I'm talking about this, because all of those who wrote against him, one of the journalists, or I don't know, they call themselves journalists from St. Petersburg, Yelena Prudnikova, blames him for the Tampax commercials that are announced on TV, because he sort of brought to life that bourgeois idea of freedom and personal comfort in a very meek way, very small way, and yet he did. And then, of course, Gorbachev came in, and then Yeltsin came in. So all of them are guilty of trying to open up that communist monolith and actually make it more livable for an individual, but he was the beginning of the end because he brought down the great skala, sort of the great monument of Stalinism, of Stalin. And I think he would always be guilty when somebody like Putin, who values the strong hand leadership, comes into the Kremlin in Russia.
Right. Now, the subtitle of your book is The Gulag, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. What is the Gulag of the Russian Mind? Because this wasn't just a book about the Khrushchevs. This was a book about the Russian soul in a lot of ways. Yes. What is the Gulag of the Russian Mind? Is there any escape from this gulag, and bearing in mind what's going on today in terms of the resurgence of nationalism and so-called patriotism? Do you see any escape from this?
As Gorbachev said, by the way, one time, в вашем вопросе уже и ответ. In your question, there is an answer. You just answered your question. Right. Yes, I mean, of course, that's the gulag. I mean, suddenly we took Crimea and we left Putin more than life itself again. He's at 80% approval. Yeah, it could be emotional, but still, we do love that. So we like our leaders strong, and I do talk about it in the book as well, that every reformer always has a very short shelf life, but every dictator or, you know, oppressor or autocrat has a very long life. Stalin, 30 years, Brezhnev, 18 years, Putin is in his 15th going. I mean, we keep predicting that he's going to fall, but so far not.
Yeah.
So it is that gulag. It's a large size. It's the imperial idea that we are better than anybody else, but the world doesn't recognize it, so we have to stick together. And the central control, which is always, I mean, democracy is a choice. Free will is a choice. We choose to wake up every morning and think about our freedoms. But when your state tells you that it knows better what to do because you have to sacrifice your individual freedoms for a great country, Russians actually very fine with that, because great country is important. That Crimea annexation, I mean, forget international laws. We want our Crimea back. We got it. And Putin showed them. I was just in Moscow and I was shocked to, I mean, my uncle Sergei actually seems to be in support of the Crimea annexation back. Yes, I mean, I know you see, I see you look in surprise. Yes, he is. And it was Khrushchev who gave it away. Khrushchev who actually tried to decentralize it. And yet there is some sort of idea of that incredible unity. I was just in Belgrade. I was, you know, obviously critical of Putin. It was a wrong audience for me to be critical of Putin, because the Slavic Brotherhood runs really high. And that's what I call the gulag of the Russian mind, is that we almost don't need the barbed wire to keep us in check. We build those walls between us and the world of our own, become victims, become misunderstood, become prosecuted, and band together in our sort of misery but greatness at the same time.
Markat, your thoughts? You're not Russian. You're Kazakh, but you grew up in the Soviet Union.
Well, they had gulags in.
They had. No, I know they had gulags in Kazakhstan.
The major part of gulag was actually in Karaganda, Karlag, and Акмола, Астана, Акмолинский лагерь, жён изменников Родины, Алжир, the hugest one. Well, for the relatives of the enemies of the Soviet Union. I think here we have, as I already mentioned before. We know that only 10% of Russian population have travel documents.
Passports, yeah, foreign passports.
Yeah, the majority goes abroad once a year to Turkey or Egypt. They don't know what Italy is, Spain is. I think the problem here is the country is huge. People don't have any chance, even though there's internet and other things there. They don't have any chance to go and see abroad and to enjoy what real freedom is. And that's a problem here. I think it will take time. And I know the former Soviets, whoever they are, Russians, Ukrainians, Kazakhs, Uzbeks, whoever, the people who grew up in the Soviet time were part of this huge, big culture. They have a lot of potential. The only thing they have to know and learn what it is. Ukrainians also were Soviets. They also had this, and the majority of the real Soviet patriots and military commanders in the Soviet Union had Ukrainian surnames, actually. And look, Ukraine today, we're here in the Czech Republic, in Poland, in Germany, we see Ukrainians everywhere.
Doing all the hard work.
Doing hard work. Yeah.
In America, too.
Yeah.
In New York.
Yeah, we see Ukrainian students here. They have, visas or even sometimes simplified visa programs. They come here. There's next to our building, there is a bus stop there. Buses connecting Prague with Uzhgorod.
With Uzhgorod, that's right.
They see what it is, and many of them started coming here before the Czech Republic became a part of NATO or European Union. They knew and they saw what it was in 1995.
And now they see what it is today.
And now they see what it is today.
Where it's indistinguishable from any Western European country.
Yeah, and when I talk to my friends who live in the United States today or Germany and who support Moscow in all this thing about Ukraine, I tell them, you know what? Not everybody is lucky like you or are eager like you to go and live in free society abroad. They want to bring this free society in their own country. And this is Ukrainians' right to bring it there and to do it there and to be the same as their yesterday's brothers in socialism campus, whatever they call it today, like Lithuanians, Estonians, Latvians, Czechs, Poles, whoever. They live much better than before. And that's what is the difference now between those who are living in the Russian Federation and in Ukraine. But someday it was going to change.
I perhaps naively in the past, I'm still not sure what I think about this. But on this podcast, on my blog, I've argued that things were changing in Russia because of demographics, basically, because the first post-Soviet generation was coming of age now. That although, yes, only 10% of Russians have travel documents, more Russians than ever are traveling casually than before. I mean, just go downtown Prague, you hear nothing but the Russian language on Wenceslas Square or in any place in the center of the city for that matter.
But it doesn't mean that all of them are from Russia.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. But this same phenomenon that's driving change in Ukraine, I was thinking would drive change in Russia with this generation coming of age. Nina, is a generation not enough to escape this gulag?
Well, I actually think that, I said it earlier and then Mikhail kind of really stressed it. It's the size, because all these countries that came out of the Soviet Union, they're lucky to be smaller in size and therefore more coherent in when they decide to change. Russia still has that empire to fall back on and to say, look at us, we're great, we're big, we're 11, well now 9 time zones, we stretch from Germany to Japan, and therefore we are. And I think that's what, for example, Ukrainians don't have it, but Russians don't want to have it because, as I said, I think democracy is a choice, and it's a harder choice to have because you have to work on it every day, but with a vertical of power. I mean, we talk about it.
Right.
It's easy to choose one formula and then stick to it. And as long as you are not, your kind of personal freedoms are not touched, you're okay with that. And I think what is changing is that I think now Vladimir Putin's system has gone after the personal freedoms. And we see how much Russians would want to deal with that. As for generation, I mean, there was a huge hope that the generational shift will bring Russia to some other formula. And in some ways it did. I mean, we saw it in 2010, 2011, 2012. Then it died down. Because I think it is part of our genetic code. While you're so big, it's very difficult to change mentality. I think the country needs to break. I mean, I know I've been killed for this argument, but here I am making it again. I think as long as we're that big, we are going to move very, very slowly. Because once again, as Mirkat pointed out, Russians can have those foreign passports, but they don't want to have them. They don't have to have them because they're private lives are fine. I mean, now they all have this washing machine, so why they have the internet, why travel? And in some ways, it makes Russia very similar to the United States, because the United States also don't travel.
Yeah, same thing could be said of Americans.
Right. But it allows, there's certainly different premises from the start of the countries, but what makes this country similar in some ways, they both remain to be ideological, and that's why we so easy fall back on the Cold War rhetoric, precisely because those who are not with us are against us. Just by definition, you don't even have to explain it anymore.
Now, you write in the book, though, that you expect, you know, after Putin, at some point, there's going to be another wave of reform, and suddenly Khrushchev's going to be in vogue again as this barometer of how things are going in Russia. And but yet, after that, he's going to be a villain again, because there's going to be, are we just doomed to this endless cycle?
Well, and that's what I think, that's actually, that really what prompted me to write the book, because when Gorbachev said, it's a free country, you do whatever you want to do. I don't know when Mirkat came to Prague, and I don't know if he immigrated or not. I just came as
95.
Okay. So it was post-Gorbachev. I just came for graduate school in 91. I mean, I was told it was a free country. I can do whatever you want. I didn't immigrate. I was a perfect Soviet citizen when I came to the States. And so when Putin came in and started saying, well, you know, you may not be able to have dual citizenship, or you may not do this, or, you know, when my passport in 2006, I wrote something about Putin and my passport was suddenly in danger. My Russian passport was suddenly, right. What am I, Solzhenitsyn? So suddenly I felt like he personally insulted me, because we finally put a stop and put to bed this debate between Westernizers and Slavophiles. And we're back at that debate again. Right. Who is better, West or East? So, and that's why I think in some ways we are doomed to the cycle. But if Russia gets smaller, I don't know how it's going to, we talked about this, I suggest Ural would become a great ski resort or something. So I think that would be the beginning of our rebirth as a normal nation. St. Petersburg, Moscow, Kiev together, those levers of Western civilization, and the rest of it, I don't know, develop some other way, give pieces to China, give pieces to Japan, return Kaliningrad to Germany, you know, have some strategic decisions.
Nina, they're never going to renew your passport.
Well, I guess I have to suffer for my thoughts.
you've kept your Russian citizenship until now.
We'll see. We don't know. I mean, I'm actually going to Moscow next week, so we'll see what happens. will I be given that?
In all seriousness, do you get nervous when you go back, because you've not exactly been friendly towards this regime?
Yeah, but I think I'm not. I mean, I really don't think I'm important enough. And I have to say, I mean, people do suffer, but I'm not Alexei Navalny. I'm really not. You know, I write puny little articles. Who cares?
No.
But it is.
I think you are well protected. First of all, with American passport. Second of all, your surname. They will never. Just imagine in the New York Times or somewhere, Khrushchev's granddaughter
arrested at Sheremetyevo.
Come on.
You know what? Actually, I know. I think the same way as you do. But for example, I think when Vladimir Putin decides to make a very important point, he actually cherishes this kind of.
That's what I mean.
We never thought that. I mean, not I am that important at all. My name is important. I'm not. But, you know, when suddenly Kasparov was arrested and Navalny was a big story, and Putin doesn't shy away from this kind of thing. So he decides to make an example out of me. I will turn up to be just like Crimea, you know, the cold. Suddenly it became everything is Khrushchev's fault. It could happen. But I don't, I mean, you know, he really has serious. I mean, you know, if he's going to arrest somebody, it would be Pussy Riot again. But why me? I'm really nothing. As I said, I do write puny articles. But sometimes I think his people are vigilant, so they want to make sure that all of us and so many of us kind of keep us slightly in check, rather than just let us go run amok. And you know, my book is not in Russian, so he can.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do you plan on getting a Russian language edition out on this?
I don't know. I'm sort of. If somebody asks me, I will do that. I'm not afraid of Putin. I am more afraid of my mother. who would say, "Well, you know, this could be. I know you mean well, and Khrushchev was. I know you are not very critical, but." It could be misinterpreted.
So your mother has no idea what.
Well, she does. I read parts of it. I deliberately read parts of it.
Uh huh.
to her, and she knows I'm critical, but I think, but my mother would, she knows it serves the family well, and she would rather not know the details.
Well, on that note, we'll shift gears into the second part of our program. In a few minutes, we'll continue our discussion of Nina's book and of the Khrushchev legacy and its relevance to Russia today. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School, as I've noted, author of the recently published book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And also joining me in our studio in Prague is Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
For the moment, you are ahead of us. We still have a lot of work to do and break some sweat to catch up with you. We'll do our best. We'll catch up. We will surpass you, and we'll go forward. That is my conviction. You may laugh now, but I'd like to see you laugh when we overtake you and say, goodbye, capitalists. Our train is going ahead.
And that, of course, was Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev during the kitchen debate with then-Vice President Richard Nixon. Mirhat, you and I were talking off mic this week as we were both reading Nina's book, speed reading it in my case, and preparing for this program in between all of our other duties here at RFL. And you said something that really struck me. You said that many of the things Nina wrote about her own family, the things that happened to them, the moral dilemmas they faced, the Faustian choices they had to make, were similar to things in your own family history. And on one hand, this should surprise nobody. You're both, you know, former Soviet citizens of the same generation, born a year or so apart, if I'm not mistaken. But on the other hand, Nina was a member of an elite Moscow family, the descendant of a former Soviet ruler. And Mirhat, you were born in a village in Kazakhstan, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So when do you get the rest of the discussion going and elaborate on some of these things that struck you in the book? And I'd like to get you and Nina
mentioned that I was very impressed by the book because every single chapter or every single part of it just rang the bell. When I was reading the book, there was a town mentioned, the Engels, the capital of the German Soviet Socialist Autonomous Republic, which was later disbanded. And I grew up among ethnic Germans in Kazakhstan. When I read this, for instance, also especially when I read about Luba's being persecuted, part of her persecution was because her mother was ethnic German and the man who with whom she had an affair, a French diplomat, has a German father.
Luba being the wife of Leonid and
well,
Nina's grandmother.
The so-called wife.
Right.
She lied that she was a wife, but, you know, his mistress at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But all the things, I immediately remembered stories by the parents of my friends, my dear friends. I hope they're still okay. Vala Eckert, Sasha Eichmann, Volodyakin's father, they told me horrible stories, what they went through, this Trudarmee, Arbeitarmee, where they were persecuted and sent to Siberia first, and many of them were sent to Kazakhstan. And when I encountered the word FZU, my God, immediately rang the bell. My uncle, Gasserbek, was sent my grandmother, Haisha, to the city, big city of Uskomenogorsk, to FZU, only to make it possible for him to survive there.
Can you explain just for our listeners who may not know what FZU is?
Yeah, FZU is a factory plant education. Usually kids were taught there to be able to become metal workers or workers at the factories. And there was a wartime when my uncle went to FZU only because there was a wartime, and I know the stories, and my grandma told me that she used the skins of sheep slaughtered ages ago to make soups for kids, for eight kids, and she wanted to send her son there so that he could at least see some better life there. And he had to come back and to change his identity because the officials and authorities were looking for him. He was caught when he was giving his bread, his ratio at FSU to Chechens who were deported by that time to Kazakhstan, and they were in Spetskomendatura. And all this, you know, every uncle, when I saw the word breast there, the beginning of the war, which is called in the former Soviet Union Great Patriotic War, my another uncle who was captured during the first week of the war at Brest, and he, since he has a very strange appearance, he well, in my village, Kazakhs are very mixed, and they don't look like real Kazakhs, and they took him for a Jew because he had that kind of appearance, and he had circumcision, and all the politruks and officers and Jews were shot, and he was shot with them, but no scratch. He fell down in the ditch and managed to get out of there, and in several days he was captured again, and this time he proved that he was not a Jew, and then there was like years and years of concentration camps and jails, years of immigration in Europe, and only after the death of Stalin he was able to go back to the Soviet Union, but immediately arrested, sent to Sakhalin to mining, and lost his arm and his sight, and he was commissioned from there because he was not able to work. He came back, and my aunt was waiting for him. They had six children of it. I saw it. It's my childhood. I was my favorite uncles told me the stories, their personal stories, you know. And all this, and again, nothing was allowed to talk freely about it. My own grandfather, Parhizat, first time when I saw how he looked like, I was 41. It was 10 years ago. I came to Almaty, and my distant relative just showed me the picture of him, and it turned out that all my relatives decided to get rid of his pictures because in 38 he was arrested and sent to Gulag because he was not able to save the harvest. There was a sudden snow in August in a small kolkhoz in East Kazakhstan Oblast. And he went to Strafbad during the war, and Strafbad is punitive battalion. Mm-hmm. They had no chance to survive. They were sent on the frontier in front of all the attacks, and there was a regular Red Army behind, and as soon as they were retreating or just trying to get out, they were shot. So he died, of course, in Ukraine. And all the stories, and every word rings the bell there, you know. Anything, Brest, you know, FSU, Germans, you know, anything. And just, it goes through me, you know. I was reading, and it was amazing how...
Well, I could tell, Merkat was absorbed in this.
Yeah, it's anyone who grew up there in my generation, and Nina is of my generation too, even us, you know, we still were in the shadows of all this. I remember in our remote village, I was coming there, seeing my uncles and my other relatives, and I remember even the spoons brought from the war had an inscription, Rheinmetall. Mm-hmm. Trophies still used there, you know. There's there's all these things. Stalin's period was still there as a shadow, you know, in our lives. You know, even my father's first typewriter was a German typewriter, which was repaired and made with Cyrillic letters there, and also turned out to be a trophy. Wow. So everything was. We were connected there. We were born just 10 years after Stalin's death. Right. You know, that's.
Nina, does it surprise you that the book would resonate so much with and the experiences you experienced as part of an elite Moscow family would resonate so much with a kid from a Kazakh village?
No, because you know we did share Soviet history, and in some ways it was, you know, one of the kind of democratic history to a degree, just because we all went through the same school, we all studied the same authors, and we all had, and Stalinism affected everybody, and it as Mikhail is saying, Germany was we defeated Germany, but at the same time everything was about, for example, the tape recorder that Khrushchev started recording his memoirs on was of course an Uhr tape recorder, which was a German tape recorder. So it was a power, defeated power, but also a very important one. But I also think what really connects, I hope, connects me with everybody else is that because Khrushchev was ousted, we had to grow up human. And I think we actually, right before you you joined us, we were talking about this, that, for example, if Brezhnev's granddaughter would write that book, it probably would be a different book, because dying in the Kremlin is not the same as being ousted in the Kremlin and sort of going through, I mean, we never went through oppression in any way, but, you know, there was one time when I knew that I was, when I was at Moscow University, I knew that I would never pass the exam of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, because my professor was a Stalinist and a Khrushchev would never pass that exam. And I think this this kind of ideological pressure we did all share. But I'm so glad that you know, that book resonated with the former Soviet, because that's what it was written about, is just to lift that veil of secrecy, but also show that as despot as Khrushchev was, he was still a different kind of leader. He was, I mean, all these clips that you're playing, just remarkable, because he was such a public politician. He almost never read from the piece of paper, and he always spoke to his opponent. I mean, it was a barrage of propaganda, but it was a propaganda that he fully believed in, and he was really good at presenting. Well, Kitchen Debates, one of the great examples.
We chose those clips for a reason.
That's why it's amazing that we never heard those when we were growing up. That's why, you know, we knew Brezhnev and we knew Stalin. And right. This is it. When you know, and only after Perestroika, there was some information coming to us, some details, how it happened, what it was, pluses, minuses. And again, it was Khrushchev's era when Gagarin went to the space.
Right.
They never said that. I mean, they said, as Ian already said, it was a Communist Party.
Right.
It was the Communist Party. Under Communist
Sputnik.
Party's guidance.
Right. Sputnik was the Communist Party.
Yeah, Sputnik happened under Khrushchev, as did Gagarin.
Right.
Nina, you noted, and you alluded to this in the first half, about how you kind of got a kind of special bond with Leonid, your grandfather, through writing this book, discovering his rebellious nature. And this really does come out. I mean, he was a bit of a playboy, a bit of a rogue. It sounds like somebody I'd like to hang out with. but he kind of represented this this potential to break out of this gulag. No, and this seems to, you seem to have inherited his spirit in a lot of ways.
I mean, in a very small way. I mean, not that I've done anything remarkably rebellious, but I do, I don't like the system. I mean, I love my grandfather, Nikita Khrushchev, but I think this, we also talked about this. I mean, this is a system that promised humanity great solutions and great happiness, and of course couldn't see the trees behind the forest and really squandered away all this potential. So he was. But also, I mean, in the book, and Mirkat mentioned, and thank you for mentioning, Leonid's thought to be wife for 75 years lied that she was the wife so she could have access to Khrushchev privileges. I mean, she was Luba. She was my mother's biological mother. She was imprisoned unjustly in 43 because to actually fight against Leonid's rebelliousness and his womanizing, she decided to take up an affair with a French military diplomat in 1942 in the middle of the war. You're like, well, really, you just need that. And then she immediately went to study French language, which, of course, was very suspicious to KGB. Why on earth, in the middle of the war, in a cruise ship, you dump your children and you go to study French? And so, I mean, once again, it was also a very human response to their oppression. But unlike Leonid, who never winked in front of the system, he would always be honest with, at least with himself, she actually took advantage of all these little imperfections and became, and for me, she was the greatest representative of the gulag of the Russian mind, because she, all her achievements are aggrandized, whatever the achievements are, and all her defeats are presented in such absolutely heroic light. You know, I do tell a story of how I finally found out that she was not married to Leonid. She lied her whole life. She dumped her children. She didn't give a damn about them. But it was all to kind of achieve the letter. So in some ways, she was a perfect communist, which is you give a great facade, but ultimately it's all hollow and empty inside, and it's not to benefit anybody, even if you claim that there is.
And outside, she never stopped believing, or at least externally, she never stopped professing to believe in the system, even after the gulag.
No, not even that, but also she never stopped professing in her own, believing in her own greatness, because once I finally got out of her that she was not married, she said, well, but the Khrushchevs were also never married, because all the Khrushchevs were never married. Nina and Nikita, they never, it was never documented. It was, you know, it was the Lenin period. Right. And you know, there was all this.
Marriage
old,
was a bourgeois institution, right?
Exactly. And so they never married. And it's like, wait a minute, you cannot really make this, you cannot make this comparison, because not being married when Stalin, and I'm sure Mirkat knows it very well from his family, when Stalin started, after the death of his wife, Nadezhda, in 32, he sort of started bringing back the family to the traditional values. So marriage became important and even necessary. So you cannot say I was not married in 1938, comparing to that to, you know, 1932.
Yeah.
And so it was a very interesting story of hers. I mean, it was an amazing heroic story. But for example, William Taubman, who wrote a great biography of Nikita Khrushchev, she even seduced him, as one time Taubman said to me, I am her last victim. Because she's so convincing in telling that kind of great Komsomol member who just charges on despite everything, but basically, like most women, especially in the old times, trying to get married to somebody important so they could advance her life position, and that, so these are I juxtapose Leonid and her, because although she lived a long life, and she presented herself as such a heroic Soviet person, actually was nothing but a shell and a hollow hollow character, while he, not professing anything, actually I think was a very very interesting guy, and he would not have lived long anyway. He would have died. He would have died because I do think that to some degree he probably had a death wish, because he couldn't fit into that system, and it was easier for him to die than to continue trying to fit into that system and argue with his father about that.
Yeah, no, he was a fascinating character.
Yeah.
Any last thoughts before we wrap it up from either of you?
I want to say that I'm very proud that Nikita Khrushchev liked Ukraine. He was very—he was not Ukrainian, although he grew up very close to Ukraine. But it also shows that not only he was human, but in some ways, please forgive me, I'm biased, he was a bit ahead of his times. He thought that Ukrainians were more special than the Russians. And Nina, my grandmother, was Ukrainian, and so I'm really, when I look at what's happening, and you know, Mirkat was talking about. So Ukrainians who want to be part of the West. I wouldn't say that Khrushchev would be supportive of this. I don't think, because he promised us communism. It didn't happen. But at the same time, he did recognize that there's a special people, special Slavs. And I think they're still kind of fitting into that, into his expectations. And I'm quite proud of him. And, you know, I'm an honorary Ukrainian. So my fellow Ukrainians here.
Right. No, one thing I did note in the final chapter, you made this, I choose to be a Khrushchev. You were thinking of changing your name back to Petrova, but you said, I choose to be a Khrushchev. Would you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, it's my mother's name, because my mother was Khrushchev's daughter. And after conversation with Molotov, I was so traumatized by that, and I was getting my passport, and I decided that I'm going to be a Khrushchev, because that was a small way of being a dissident in the USSR, where Khrushchev, as Mirkan pointed out, was not mentioned. So I became that. But now it was, you know, it's actually a privilege to be it, because I don't have to be. My father's name is Petrov, and I'm Nina Petrova by birth, given my father's name. But now, you know, I've been with his name for 30 plus years. I do choose to be a Khrushchev, and especially now, I actually feel like in Putin's time, finally, I got another cause, because so the cycle, reformers go down, dictators go up. And so in some ways, I have a reason to be a Khrushchev, although of course, years from now, I may not have one. But we'll see. I mean, it depends on how big Russia remains, or if it collapses into smaller pieces. And so reformers then would take precedence for many, many years and centuries to come, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. All right. Last word to you, Marco.
Well, again, I think work, the book, is very important, not only for those who lived in the Soviet Union, grew up there, but it's very important for those who are interested in Russia today and those who try to understand what's happening there. And I think Khrushchev is not only a barometer. Khrushchev is a flag if we put in this way.
And, oh, thank you.
Yeah, and we have to remember that as soon as a person who is a lucky man, I mean, Khrushchev, I just looked through it, as you mentioned already, he was ousted, but he was not executed, sent to Gulag, anything, but his name has to be mentioned more and more often, especially within Russia, so that people could understand what he, this person, did and his contribution. And that we have to remember that there was the first person who openly said that Stalinism is bad, that the totalitarian regime is a bad thing. He probably did some mistakes, which he did mistakes. There are some other issues and problems. I understand that, but
it was the first chip in the monolith.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And then we have to just remember this guy. And I am very happy that I am able to speak to Nina Khrushcheva. I never dreamed that you'd be talking to Khrushchev's granddaughter.
I'm available.
Yeah. All right. So thank you very much.
All right, and that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today, but I think we'd need a whole month of podcasts to do this interesting book justice. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School, and as I've noted throughout the podcast, the author of the recently published book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. I've got my copy, now go get yours. And also joining me from our studio in Prague has been Mirkat Shudupjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL Central Newsroom, who also has his copy. Thanks to both of you for a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and very overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.